This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you all for coming, and thank you for inviting me to give this lecture. So I've been asked to speak with you about TAVR evolution and vascular implications. I have no disclosures for this talk. Aortic stenosis has many different etiologies, of course, as you all know. It can be congenital, bicuspid, or unicuspid aortic stenosis. It can be rheumatic heart disease, which presents often with a mixture of aortic stenosis and aortic regurgitation. And the number of patients that we see in the United States with rheumatic disease is definitely not going up, but it's either plateaued because of the patients who come to the U.S., or it's on the way down. However, calcific degenerative aortic stenosis is on the rise. And interestingly, the same risk factors that cause vascular atherosclerotic disease from head to toe appears to also be the reason why calcific degenerative aortic stenosis is on the rise. And some of these risk factors, I've outlined them here: age, of course, history of smoking, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and abnormal LP little a levels or renal insufficiency or hypercalcemia can all lead to calcific degenerative aortic stenosis. It turns out that one out of four adults in this country over 65 years old has some degree of aortic stenosis, which is a pretty high number, considering that we're living longer and longer in this country. This is just a typical picture of mild aortic stenosis to your left and more severe aortic stenosis. You can see the tri-leaflet aortic valve, and you can see some mild calcification and degenerative disease on the left here, whereas you can see much more advanced disease noted for severe calcific aortic stenosis. The classification of severity of aortic stenosis has been simplified recently to mild, moderate, or severe. Mild is an area of valve area of greater than 1.5 centimeters squared, a mean gradient less than 25 millimeters of mercury, and a jet velocity of less than 3 meters per second. Severe, on the other hand, is an area of less than 1 centimeter squared with a mean gradient of greater than 40 and a jet velocity of greater than 4 meters per second. When we evaluate patients for aortic stenosis, we don't just rely on a single number that I've listed here, but we look at the whole patient and consider many of these severity scores. And we also account for the body surface area. Some little old lady may be very different compared to a 6'9 individual. And, of course, symptoms predominate. If somebody has symptomatic aortic stenosis that you're certain is coming from that aortic valve, then it's time to do something about it. Why is symptoms so important? Well, from historical studies, we know for a long time now that if patients are asymptomatic with even severe aortic stenosis, for many, many years, they do very well. And on the x-axis, you can see this is 10 years and 20 years, and these patients tend to do well. The minute they begin to have symptoms, then it's quite bad. The risk of mortality, this is survival on the y-axis, is pretty bad. And the three main symptoms that we look for are heart failure symptoms, syncopal events, or angina, that you've ruled out underlying coronary disease as etiology for their angina. So the minute the patients start having heart failure, syncope, or angina, you know that the time is ticking, and you can't just keep following these patients unless you do something about them. It turns out, though, that despite the rise in the number of patients with symptomatic aortic stenosis, one out of three patients with severe AS do not undergo aortic valve replacement surgery. And this is a number of different studies, and you can see that up to 30 to 50%, if not more, of these patients are untreated because of the comorbidities as the patients get older and all the other risk factors that they have. So one out of three patients with symptomatic aortic stenosis in this country are not having open surgical aortic valve replacement surgery. And the prognosis is quite bad, and you can compare them to many different cancers. This is breast cancer, lung cancer, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, and ovarian cancer. And out here is symptomatic, severe, inoperable aortic stenosis. And the outcome for these patients from a survival perspective is actually far worse than any of the cancers that I've listed there. So the idea has been that if these patients are such high surgical, open surgical candidates, could we less invasively replace that valve? And so TAVR, the first case was done by Dr. Alain Cribier in France in 2002. And this used to be called PAVR, percutaneous aortic valve replacement, and then it was TAVI, which is the aortic valve implantation. But the going term these days is TAVR, which is a transcatheter aortic valve replacement. It is commonly done via a transfemoral system or approach versus a transapical, but there are many other approaches that I'll get into as to how we can get to the aortic valve. The first version of the valve that had been studied in the PARTNERS trial, which we'll review in detail, was the Edwards valve, and it was either designed to go transfemorally across the aortic valve into the ventricle and deployed that way, or transapically, essentially doing a cut down at the apex of the heart and directly puncturing the LV apex and going integrate across the aortic valve into the aorta and then deploying your valve. And of course, you want to make sure that you know exactly how you're implanting your valve if you're coming transfemorally versus transapically, because if you implant your valve in the incorrect position, the patient will die right there on the table because the valve is going to open the wrong way, obviously. This is the Edwards Sapien transcatheter heart valve. You can see that this is a bovine pericardial tissue, which is sewn up onto a stainless steel frame. And you can see this green marker here. This green marker always ends up inside the ventricle. So this green marker and the shape of this, you can see these are open cell and this is closed here. So this, we always have to make sure that it is on the ventricular side for deployment purposes. So when you come from each direction, you need to double check, triple check, and make sure. The study devices, there was a retroflex catheter going from the femoral approach. There were either 22 or 24 French sheets. And the Ascendra, which is the transapical catheter, was 24 or 27 French sheet catheters for the initial PARTNERS trial. The two sizes available for the clinical trial, the 23 millimeter covered valve areas between 18 to 20 millimeter, and the 26 covered areas between aortic valve sizes of 23 to 25. And you can see that in the middle, you basically have to figure out, are you going to upsize a 23 valve to cover a 21 valve versus downsize a 26 valve to cover a 22 valve? So it's not a perfect technology yet. And there are patients, it turns out, that they actually have valves that are bigger than 25 millimeters, and the Edwards Sapien valve was just not big enough for their annulus to actually be implanted. And we'll get into that in a second. Be that as it may, the large U.S. partner study was designed looking at symptomatic severe aortic stenosis patients, and they had about 1,000 patients, and there were two parts to this trial. There was a partner A and a partner B. Partner A was about 700 patients who were deemed to be by two CT surgeons to be high risk for surgery for open aortic valve replacement, and about 350 patients were inoperable. So two CT surgeons agreed that this patient is just too high risk for them to undergo open aortic valve replacement. So let's review the Part B, which was published initially, Partners B. Inoperable patients that were randomized to, okay, we're not going to operate with them, which is what they're getting today, and versus randomizing them to a TAVR procedure. And for this group, only transfemoral TAVR was offered, not a transapical TAVR versus standard therapy. How did these patients do? Well, if you follow them to 1 and 2 years respectively, you can see in yellow here, this is the standard medical therapy group, that as expected, they had about a 50%. One out of two of these patients were dead by 1 year. Whereas if they got the TAVR procedure, there was still a pretty high 30% mortality, but there was a delta of about 20%, and the number needed to treat to save one life was 1 out of 5, which is pretty amazing for a technology that had just come out. And this was actually still consistent and true at the 2-year follow-up, and subsequent follow-up and other studies have shown that to be true. Now, moving on to the high-risk patient population, the high-risk patients were, again, two CT surgeons thought that, yeah, I can probably operate on this patient, but the patient is pretty high risk. So let's randomize them to either a transfemoral TAVR or a transapical TAVR. And within each group, they were still one-to-one randomized to transfemoral TAVR versus open surgical AVR. And in the transapical TAVR, they were randomized to transapical TAVR versus surgical open AVR. So how did this patient population do? And the all-cause mortality at 1 year, you can see this is the curve for the open AVR, and this was the curve for the TAVR patients. So these are your high-risk patients who two surgeons have deemed to be too high risk, and it turns out that the mortality at 1 year and 2 years was identical with the TAVR procedure. The transfemoral and transapical approaches both had identical results, and there was no significant differences in terms of mortality at 1 year. It was not all good because there were some side effects, and the big side effect is stroke. And as you can see in the TAVR group, at 30 days, there was 5.5% risk of stroke versus open surgical AVR, which was 2.4, and this reached statistical significance at 0.04. So when we talk to our patients for open versus a TAVR procedure, be it transfemoral or transapical, irrespective of that, the risk of stroke is indeed a little bit higher with the TAVR procedure compared to open surgical AVR. As we are learning more and more about the TAVR and the instruments are getting smaller and smaller in size, the risk of stroke has certainly decreased across the world for people who are doing these procedures, but still, that's something that is of great concern. For this talk specifically, what are the major vascular complications with TAVR? So this is, if you look at this slide, this is the Edwards the TAVR procedure versus the open surgical AVR, and you can see that the major vascular complications are certainly higher, about 10-11% at 30 days with the TAVR procedure versus open surgical AVR. At 1 year and 2 years, it appears that this has plateaued off, but clearly this is from a vascular procedure perspective. If you're doing a transfemoral TAVR, it is accompanied by a higher risk. What are some of these, let me talk about the bleeding, and I'll tell you what some of the issues are from vascular perspective. Bleeding, it turns out, was high, it was 10%, but actually it was much lower than open surgical AVR with the TAVR versus AVR. So what are the surgical vascular complications that we can see? And you have to be prepared to see any of these because you don't know what's going to happen when you're starting your case. And, of course, in the 64 patients who had major vascular complications, about 60% of them had vascular dissections. About 30% of them had vascular perforations. About 22% of them had access site hematoma. About 9 or 10% of them had retroperitoneal bleeding. 3% had false pseudoaneurysms, and 1.5% of patients actually had GI ischemia. So these are pretty bad complications that, as we've learned more about the TAVR, there are strict screening processes that every patient undergoes to try to minimize all these side effects. If you were to have a major vascular complication, no surprise to anyone here, you will die more. Your death rate is far higher. Anybody in red who had a major vascular complication compared to somebody who did not obviously have a major vascular issue. So how do we assess appropriate vascular access? Every single patient who has a normal creatinine or GFR will get a CT scan from chest, abdomen, and pelvis down to look for calcification, tortuosity, and at every level we figure out exactly what the minimal diameters are. If somebody has a high creatinine, I've had a few patients that have had to IVUS up and down the whole way on both sides to make sure that we actually know exactly what the minimal luminal diameter is. For the currently available FDA-approved Edwards devices, which is a 23-millimeter valve, which requires a 22 French retroflex sheath, you need at least a minimal diameter of 7 from the common femoral artery above. And for the 26-millimeter valve, that's the second one, the larger one that's available, you need at least an 8-millimeter vascular access site from common fem above, and this requires a 24 French sheath. However, things are getting better and better. Technology improves. On the left is what we have today. In a few weeks, we expect the FDA to approve the new generation already, the second generation Edwards Sapien XT device, that instead of the 22-24 French sheet sizes, we can go down to 18-19 French sheet devices, which is going to be a whole lot easier to try to get these devices up and around into the aorta and into across the aortic valve to the ventricle. There's, of course, this is a big market. Many, many companies are into this. Medtronic, St. Jude's, and there are many different variations. And for those of you who have kept up with the literature and also the American College of Cardiology, the core valve result was presented. And the core valve has some advantages. It's an 18 French delivery for the 26, 29, 31 millimeter valve. This is now FDA approved. It goes only transfemoral or subclavian delivery. It does not have a transapical approach system. And the good thing about this is that as opposed to the balloon expendable Edwards, this actually is a repositionable self-expanding system. So you can essentially figure out, is this a good position? Is this up? Is this low? So this may be an advantage for a certain number of patients. However, this device, as opposed to the Edwards valve, because of the way that it implants into the intraventricular septum, it pushes your conduction system, and that the requirement for pacemaker placement is somewhat higher with this device than it is with the Edwards device. So let me show you an example of a case I did about a month or so ago. This is a 91-year-old guy. So the first question is, 91? Are you out of your mind what you're doing a 91-year-old? Well, it turns out this was a very functional 91-year-old who lived independently, you know, gardened, traveled, did everything. And he had significant coronary disease with left main LAD, left circ, and RCA. We had to reconstruct his whole coronary anatomy because he was deemed to be an inoperable surgical candidate. And he had that extremely critical, actually, aortic valve stenosis with a valve area of about 0.3 to 0.4. So for him, after we reconstructed it, he had a CT scan done, and surprisingly, as I'll show you, he had pretty good femoral anatomy for us to put in a valve, and it turned out that for him, unfortunately, his valve was big enough that we needed to put in the 26-millimeter valve because the XT is still not available, and he was quite symptomatic, so we had to proceed. So this required a 24 French sheath, and I can tell you the first number of cases we did this, either our vascular colleagues or the CT surgeon, they do a cut down for us, and we go in, and now it's easy enough to have good access for the procedure. In this case, we decided that with a vascular surgical backup, we decided to do the whole thing percutaneously. So let me just show you how it worked out. So this, we initially got access on the right groin, and we did an angiogram. And as you can see, for a 91-year-old, it's pretty impressive. It's not that bad looking. So then we go up and around. We put a Pictel catheter up and around into the left groin, and we did a left angiogram here. And let's see that. So that looks pretty good. So we have a good puncture site here. We got access there, no problem, and we decided that we're going to pre-close this, and we actually deployed three pre-close devices at 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and 2 o'clock. You can even do more if you want, but in case one of the sutures break, you want to have additional pre-closes. In this case, we did three pre-closes, as stated. And then what we had a sheet that was a guide catheter up and around and the common iliac on the left. And we advanced a 300-centimeter steel core wire all the way down to the SFA. And this essentially helps us, in case there is going to be a vascular complication, to very quickly be able to deliver a balloon and occlude a flow downstream that way. Once we had the access here, we had our 300-centimeter steel core wire in the SFA. We pulled back this guide catheter and just parked it right here in the right common iliac, and then we're able to get our large sheath in place. And so let me orient you here. There's a lot of stuff going on in there in the heart, but let's start from here. So the sheath essentially is a 24 French sheath is sitting right here in the descending aorta. This patient already had a pacemaker in place, which helps us. But what we do to implant these valves, we have to really pace them very rapidly at 180 beats per minute. So you essentially want cardiac standstill because as you're trying to position your aortic valve, if there's any contractile motion, this valve is going to shoot out of the aortic valve into the aorta, and that could be a disaster. So what you see here we have a temp wire right here from the right femoral groin, and now we're going to tacky pace this patient to 180 beats a minute, and you essentially have no blood pressure here for about 30, 40 seconds. Blood pressure falls to about 10, 15 millimeters of mercury systemically, and we can go ahead now position this valve. We have a Pictel catheter right above the aortic valve, which you'll see in a second. So there's a Pictel where this is tri-leaflet aortic valve. You can see all the stents in this guy's coronaries that we put in. And now, tacky pace, the heart is going to stop. When the heart stops, we slowly just inflate, and then boom, we just deploy this valve in the hopefully correct position. And we got a very good result with this gentleman, and we got the gradient down to zero. And there it goes. The balloon is down. So this just shows it again. So you want to make sure that you are well aligned. You don't want to be too low. You don't want to be too high. If you're too low, you're going to screw up your mitral valve apparatus. If you're too high, you may essentially gel off your coronary arteries, and that could be a disaster. So then we turn our attention to closing the groin. So we advanced the 10 by 40 balloon to the left common external iliac over that steel core wire that was still sitting there for the whole time. And we inflated at low pressure here, and we deployed our percloses, the pre-closed devices, all three of them. And then we brought the balloon down. We did a very, very gentle inflation at just one atmosphere for 5 minutes at the common femoral head. And we took an angiogram, and this is what it looked like. So this is the final concluding angiogram with a 26-millimeter Edwards valve, 24 French sheath. So we got a good result with him. But this is something that if you're doing these procedures, you need to closely work with your vascular surgeons. Some patients are definitely going to need a cut down. And clearly, you know, in this case, we got away with it. And we've done many of these pre-closes. In fact, Warren and I were involved with one at the VA just 2 weeks ago. And again, we did the whole 26 with a three pre-closed devices. And that worked out very well, too. So the future of TAVR, just to try to stay on time here, it's actually quite bright, not just for TAVR alone, but all percutaneous valvular diseases in the future are going to be treated less invasively, and that's the future of valvular heart disease. So devices are getting better, they're becoming low profile, they're becoming repositionable, as I mentioned, so it's not this one and done. You can't just deploy it and pray, I'm like, oh my God, I hope this is not too high, not too low, despite all the measurements that we make. Devices are going to become retrievable pretty soon. So if you don't like the position of the valve, no problem. Take it out and reposition it. Now, paravalvular leak has been an issue with some of these valves, and it turns out that paravalvular leak is a bad thing, and there are devices that are going to come up to try to diminish the risk of this. Delivery system options, as I've gone over some of them with you today, they're getting better. Eliminate need for pacing. That would be great, so we don't have to freak out in the lab that, oh, my God, this pressure is like 10 and 20, and, you know, and you know, that can be testy sometimes, waiting for the pressure to come up. And clearly, stroke remains a problem with this procedure. And where is the etiology of stroke? Is it at the time of valve deployment? The valve is so diseased and calcified. Or is it just the whole entry and going across the aorta that all this crud you're going to cause them to embolize to the brain? So people are developing embolic protection devices to the cerebral vessels or capture devices. And, you know, we'll probably see those in the future as well. So just to finish up, I have two questions for the audience. Question one is, TAVR FDA approved for use in bicuspid aortic valve stenosis? Yes or no? So 30% said yes, 67% said no. In fact, it is not approved for bicuspid aortic stenosis. TAVR is approved only for a tri-leaflet aortic valve. So sometimes the leaflets are so calcified that on echo it's really hard to know if if this is a bicuspid valve or it's tri, but the raphes are essentially attached to each other. So we sometimes have to do CT scan. And the reason for that is that you get a lot of paravalvular AI if it's a bicuspid valve with this currently designed valves that we have available to us. And it turns out that even for tri-leaflet valve, this is important for the audience to be aware of because this is a fairly new in the literature now, is that even if you have the tri-leaflet aortic stenosis and you put a TAVR valve in, the degree of aortic insufficiency, paravalvular AI, is associated with worse outcomes. And if you see here in white is none or trace paravalvular AR, and yellow is mild and moderate to severe, and this is over time and this is mortality, you can see that you have moderate to severe aortic regurge, paravalvular leak. These patients tend to do much worse. And so when we do these procedures, we always do it with transesophageal echo right then and there, and we make sure that we don't have a lot of residual paravalvular AI. What if you do have it? Well, you can put a balloon in and upsize it a little bit, or if that doesn't take care of a problem for a couple of cases, we've had to actually put a second valve inside of the first valve, and that often takes care of the problem. But you don't want your patients to leave your OR with moderate to severe paravalvular AI. The other things that I personally haven't done, but it's in the literature for this purpose, is to put plugs into the site of the paravalvular leak. You can bring them back weeks and months later and just plug up that hole with one of these vascular plugs. Last question here for the audience before we move on to the next speaker. Question two, is TAVR FDA approved for use as treatment for aortic valve regurgitation? So I just told you if paravalvular AR is bad, but is this approved for patients with bad AR at baseline? Yes or no? Okay, so similar numbers, 20 versus 80%. So it turns out that it is not approved. So the only approved indication in this country is high risk or non-operable tri-leaflet aortic stenosis patients. Next year, if you invite me back, the indications may change, but this is where we stand today. Thank you for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.